Proverbs 18, verse 9.
Is there a shower up there?
There are 26 showers up there. There's plenty. Maybe not 26. There's probably 6 showers. This is not a small place. Yep, this will qualify. All right, 18:9. Somebody read that. All right, what's our other version say? Derek, were you reading?
One who is slack in his work is brother to one who destroys.
Man, that sounds so similar. Perfect.
A lazy person.
Okay. What are we talking about here? He who is slack in his work. What does that mean to be slack in your work?
Lazy,
not doing completion. That word slack is translated negligent at times here in the Old Testament. So it's the idea of not doing your job correctly, not doing it well. Kind of like maybe set up and not. That was nice. I'm sorry. That was too much. It's just the idea of not doing your job with excellence. What is that likened to? Is a brother, what does that mean? A brother to him who destroys.
Maybe like their brother's also horrible and they drop on each other.
Potentially.
They're of the same kin.
Yeah, they're of the same kin. How so? I mean, are we talking about blood brothers here? What are we speaking of?
Their habits.
They're the same, right? So what's the difference between someone that just absolutely comes in with a bulldozer and wrecks everything to the person that just does his job, you know, kind of halfway? What's the ultimate end of both of those?
Failure.
Destruction, failure. What's the difference? Time. One's going to happen now, the brother of him who destroys. One's going to happen over time. But the end result's the same. So whether you do your job poorly now, in a horrible way, right, and destroy it, or you do your job in a sloppy way and you do 50, 60, 70% of it, but you don't finish it or don't do it with excellence, the end result's the same. They're going to be destroyed. Our pastor tells a story back in Denton of a guy that was in the congregation that was an architect, and he wore on his pinky finger a steel ring, really simple steel ring. He asked him about it, thought it was a family heirloom. He said, no, I got this from graduation from the architectural school that I went to in Canada. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, in Vancouver, there was a bridge called the Twin Narrows Bridge. Fell, was destroyed, and they took that steel from that bridge, melted it down, and every graduate of that architectural school gets this ring. And it's a reminder. The reason the bridge failed was because they made the bolts on the bridge too small. They tried to save money and shave costs, and as a result of not making these bolts to spec, they couldn't handle the weight, torsional strength, whatever, right? You guys figured that out. You're smarter than me. And the bridge ended up falling. A bunch of people died. Lives were lost. Tragedy incurred because someone was slack in their work. Wanted to save a buck or couldn't design something properly. And every time those architects now look at their finger, they're reminded of that. Of the smallest things I do, the little things that I put my hand to the plow to accomplish, those matter, okay? It's a great lesson for you and I, right? There are times in our worlds, as young men and women, the jobs that we go about specifically, the things that we get paid to do, don't feel very noble. There are always parts of our jobs that don't feel noble, right? Whether you're coding for a seminary that's miles and miles away, whether you're, you know, my first job was hanging clothes at a women's clothing store in the back room. Like, you talk about nauseating. I don't know how I got that job, but I unboxed women's clothes, put them on hangers, and took them out. It was awful. We all have stuff like that. Mowing yards, cleaning toilets, right? There are times that we just don't feel like our job is super redemptive and a part of the grand scheme of God for the redemptive purposes of humanity, right? But everything that we do matters. It speaks to us. It speaks to our God. It speaks to whom we serve in a bigger picture. So as you guys are in the monotony sometimes of life, and as you are in the season of life that God has you in, remember that. Everything you do matters, even the little things. And as you look at the guys in Scripture that do the little things well, those are the guys and the men and the women that get exalted. Joseph coming up that we're going to study here in like 8 months by the time we get to the end of Genesis, is an amazing guy. And the reason that he gets exalted so quickly in the midst of one of his stations of life is because he's faithful in the little things and he's trustworthy and gets them done, okay? So regardless of how noble your job feels or doesn't, whatever station of life you happen to be in, the little things matter and sometimes can have dire consequences when we do them wrong. So good reminder to you and I that that's part and partial to our integrity and who we are as Christians, all right? Thoughts on that?
That's good, Mike. Thank you, man. I've been really burned out lately on God, man. So that's encouraging for me.
Yeah.
Good, sobering reminder.
Yeah. Even in the best jobs, there's always 20% of stuff that we're like, nah, I wish someone else would do that, right? It doesn't matter what you're doing. Yep, it's a good reminder. So, okay? All right, Genesis 6. Let's go back. Let's see. Jordan, will you pray for us this morning, my friend?
Absolutely.
And we'll dive in.
Heavenly Father, Lord, we thank you for another opportunity just to come together and learn your word. We ask, Lord, that we can see you through it and that because of the information that we received today in our conversation through my Lord, that you just bring us a greater awareness of who you are. We can serve you and glorify your name in all that we do. And Lord, give us what we have not, make us what we are not, and teach us what we know not. And we pray this all in your Son's name.
Amen. All right, so we finished yesterday, 4 and 5, walked through civilization, right? We saw the two lines of Adam and Eve, the godly line of Seth and the ungodly line of Cain. Saw the effects of that, of a generation that didn't walk with God, or multiple generations that didn't, that ended with Lamech, the guy that raised his fist from Cain's line, the seventh generation in, and said, "The heck with you, God. If you think Cain is bad, I'm uber bad," whatever that may be, right? If he's going to be avenged sevenfold for his murdering of a man, then me 77-fold, I'm going to take two wives, I'm going to disobey the counsel of God, and we saw the ungodly line and where that ended up. The godly line of Seth, who was the replacement to Abel, who was killed by his brother. We see that end up with then Enoch is a guy that's mentioned in there. Then finally with Noah. And Noah is going to be the guy that brings about rest. Okay, so that was the end of chapter 5. We saw those two lines. And then in chapter 6, we got into some crazy weird text. The sons of God intermingling with the daughters of men. Talked about the different possibilities of what that could be. The end result of that inbreeding of what I believe to be fallen angels, demons, and man was the Nephilim, these fallen ones, these giants of the land. As a result of that, as well as what's happening on the earth and man's intent being evil all the time, God says, we're done. We're going to hit the do-over button. We're going to save Noah, his wife, his three sons, their three wives. 8 people are going to live. And then we're going to take everybody under the ark, as you guys know the story, and we're going to start this thing over. Okay? So we ended up in end of like 6, 10, 13, somewhere in that realm. And now we're going to see the flood coming. We're going to see, obviously, Noah called to build a boat. So let's pick up there in chapter 6, and let's watch now the command of God is what he calls Noah to do. Somebody pick up in 6:14, and let's watch from here.
Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Take rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you are to make it. The length of the ark is 300 cubits, its breadth is 50 cubits, and its height is 30 cubits.
All right, so pause there for a second. So we see God call now Noah to make this gigantic boat, an ark, and he's going to give very clear dimensions to all of it, okay? Made out of gopher wood, whatever the heck gopher wood is. Nobody knows what that is other than Noah just told his kids, gopher wood, gopher wood, gopher wood. So bad. Sorry, I had to. It's so bad. Anyway, yeah, thank you, Kyle. See, you know what? This is my favorite. No, no. New favorite. All right, so it's covered, rooms pitch, covered with tar is the idea, some type of sealing agent that would keep it watertight. 15, we get this, the dimensions, 300 cubits by 50 cubits by heights will be 30 cubits. What's a cubit, by the way? Where do we get that? What's that in reference to? Almost, yeah. It's about 18 inches. It's from your elbow to your wrist, okay? So this is a cubit. So in our day, and obviously, you know, mine's going to be different than so-and-so's, so depending on your height, 18 inches is about the standard for what a cubit is. So if you want to throw down some dimensions, this boat is going to be 450 feet long, okay, 75 feet wide and 45 feet tall. It would have had a 1.4 million cubic foot capacity, okay? So just to give you an idea, a football field is 300 feet long. So this is a football field and a half long. This is a big boat, okay? So it's not a small vessel. This thing's 75 feet wide, would have fit within the confines of a football field. Football field's what, 50 yards wide, is that right? No. I think it is, yeah. I think it's right. Anyway, it's a large, long boat. I heard about this. Any of you guys read about this? Yeah. Yeah. That they just finished. It's like a, yeah, in like a multi-million dollar project. So we should do that as like a residency assignment. We should all fly out to Kentucky. Yeah. I'll ask Shay if we have some leftover budget. So what do plane tickets cost these days? 45 feet high. So 30 cubits, 45 feet high. Okay. And then you're going to get a little bit of detail. So you get the external 16. You shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit from the top. Set the door to the ark on the side of it. You shall make it lower, second, and third deck. So we have a vessel with three decks on it. It's going to have a window and a door. There are your instructions. What else? If you're thinking about building a boat, if you wanted to be in a boat at sea for 377 days, what else would you like on that boat that is interestingly missing from this? Vents would be good. Some bathrooms would be nice. A mast. Is that what you said?
Snack.
Snack. Katie's on Dinnerland still. It's a light dinner. Do I bring a snack? She's still there. What should I eat? It's all right. Come back. We're going to give you a snack, Katie. You'll be okay. Lots of snacks this weekend. How about some way to control the boat? Is there a rudder? Is there a mast? Is there any? No. This is a gigantic box of wood on the water, okay? It is a coffin in a lot of ways. It is a floating box of wood that Noah has no control over. He's going to have a window to see out, okay? There's going to be a gigantic door that we're going to find out. That's how the animals get in, but God's going to shut it. He's going to seal it from the outside. So, like, you're not going anywhere, so you got a window. That's it, okay? So there's your vent stack. So probably was a pretty dark place, I would imagine. So it's a very simple boat, and God designs it that way for a reason. Okay, 17. Keep going. Let's watch what God's going to do and why this instruction's coming. All right, so God says, this is what's coming. This is why you're building a boat, okay? But, 18, this is fascinating.
But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons, and your wife, and your sons' wives with you.
So God says, I'm going to establish my covenant with you. This is the first time we've seen this word. Now, we've talked through three different covenants, or two that we've seen so far, the Edenic covenant, the command to Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply, though we didn't see that idea of covenant language. That's the idea that there's a covenant between man and God. God is calling man to be responsible with something. There was a disobedience. There was a punishment for that disobedience, and then a new dispensation, a new ruling into which they entered into. So we had the Edenic kind of season, if you will, the innocence, time of innocence, and then the Adamic covenant. Was the idea of God saying, I'm going to bring a singular male pronoun to deal with this issue of sin. We obviously know that to be Jesus. And now we're seeing now another covenant here, the Noahic covenant. We're going to see it here in chapter 6, and then we're going to see it again. We're going to see exactly what that covenant is when they get off the boat in chapter 8, verse 21. But this is the first time we actually see this term covenant in Scripture. It's the word berit, B-E-R, where did I write that down? B-E-R-I-T-H, okay? It literally means to cut, is where the etymology of that word comes from, okay? We're going to see that language very clearly with Abraham and God when they cut a covenant together. Why would that language be used? Thomas, did you have a thought? Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Sorry.
Possibly. No, it's okay. When God makes a covenant with Abraham, he's going to have Abraham bring a bunch of clean animals, and then he's going to cut them in half and make Abraham walk through the pieces. And the idea is, if you break this covenant that we are entering into, or if I, as God, break this covenant that we are entering into, may the same happen to you. May the same happen to me. It's an imagery of, like, this is serious. I'm not screwing around. This is not a... of animals.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Then they walk through.
Yeah, the passing of the parts. You'll see
that.
You think? So, we'll talk through that, okay? Yeah. But it's what I want you guys to see. This is very, very strong language, okay? By the way, just for Mike's future soapboxes that he will get on, this is the same language used of the marriage covenant. When man and wife become one flesh for life, the same language is used, okay? And when you see how God takes these covenants that he makes with his people, he is not screwing around. It is not a, man, as long as I wake up feeling okay and I've had, you know, two cups of coffee and I'm not grumpy and I love you and, you know, whatever. He is very, very serious about keeping his word. So just as a reminder of that, okay? So, I'm going to establish my covenant with you, says God in 18 to Noah and his family. Okay, every living thing, verse 19, you're going to bring to the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female of the birds of the air. Verse 20, the animals of the ground, every creeping thing on the ground after its kind, two of every kind shall come to you to keep them alive. So, God is going to bring those to Noah. By the way, the idea of Noah running around and grabbing all the animals two by two, how do they come? What does the text say? God efficaciously draws them to the ark. Noah's just standing there by the door saying, okay, good, all right, zebra, all right, where'd the unicorn go? Oh, dang it, you know. But he's literally just, they are drawn by God. So the ark, by the way, is a really cool picture of salvation, okay? Not necessarily why this was written, but it's fascinating to look at it with those lenses. God the Father is going to draw whom he wants to it. He's going to put them inside. They will be safe. They will be carried through the storms of life, if you will, and God will take care of the whole process, okay? Noah has a responsibility to build, to get this thing ready, and to go from there, okay? Verse 22, Noah is obedient. He says that God commanded him, and he did according to what God said, okay? 21, also, I skipped that. They're going to bring food on the ark. They're also going to bring, you'll see in 7 verses 1 and following, you're going to take clean animals with you, 7:2 by sevens, male and female, and animals that are not clean too, a male and female. So after you've gathered all the animals that are coming on the ark by twos, you're going to get another set of animals, clean animals and unclean animals. What would those be for? Extra animals. For sacrifice, okay? One of the first things Noah's going to do when he gets off the boat is offer a sacrifice to God. So we've seen this idea of sacrifice all the way back to Cain and Abel, that this practice is already happening. God doesn't formalize that until later, and it's really not until the book of Leviticus where God's going to lay out, there's this sacrifice and that sacrifice, this is how you do this one, this is what this one means, this is when you do this and how you do that. But that practice is already going. So that idea of blood atonement and different sacrifices for different things are already in play. Okay, so that's the idea. Verse 4, somebody pick up there.
For after 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made.
I mean, this is serious. So if you're not in the sea, if you breathe air, you're going to die. So every land-dwelling animal is going to die. Okay, so it is a pretty major deal. Noah did, verse 5, according to all that the Lord had commanded him. By the way, they've got to get on the boat. God's going to seal it. And then they have to wait 7 days before God brings rain. By the way, have we seen rain on the earth yet?
No.
There is no such thing as rain yet. How does How does the earth get watered? How does the vegetation get taken care of at this point? Same way, right? We still got the vapor canopy above the earth that we talked about as God created the earth in Genesis 1 and 2. And then we've got this God's fancy automatic sprinkler system. So Noah's building a boat for this thing called rain that they've never seen before, right? This is kind of insane. He probably looked like a lunatic. I mean, in all honesty. So there had to be some mocking of him. This thing took a while to build. It doesn't make any sense why you would build a boat on a landlocked piece of, you know, land, right? It doesn't make any sense. But Noah does this. We see kind of the aftermath of that as we kind of continue moving forward here. Noah and his sons in verse 7, his wives entered in the ark with them. So again, 8 people God's going to save. Noah and his wife, his 3 sons, and their 3 wives as well. Verse 10, it came after 7 days that the water of the flood came upon the earth. So they get in the boat. God seals it behind them. We'll see here in just a second. And 7 days they have to sit on the boat and wait in anticipation for God to do what he said. Okay, verse 11 now, let's watch what happens. How do we get this much rain on the earth? All right, so we see the fountains of the deep were burst open. What would that be? Something, right? This is the automatic sprinkler system. Just blew a pipe, right? It's open. It is on full blast, okay? And the floodgates of the sky, what would that be? Rain. Yeah. Specifically from where? sky. That is a great answer. Sorry. This is the vapor canopy. God just poked a hole in it, okay? And this vapor canopy, it seems that is above the earth, is now emptying its contents. So what was, the environment that what was, is no longer. There's not enough water on this earth to cover the earth in rain. Some believe because of that, this was just a localized flood, like just local to this area in the Middle East. Some believe it's worldwide because there's not enough water to cover the earth, so it has to be local. I believe that it's a worldwide flood, and it seems to be what the scripture indicates. Now, sometimes when we see the word earth, it's referring to the known earth that they know at that time. So, man, your guess is as good as mine. It certainly seems to lean to the entire world at this point. Yeah, I've seen or heard of that. Yeah. So.
Has what?
They have seashells.
Seashells?
At the very, very top.
Oh.
Yeah.
By seashell, what is seashell?
Yeah. So
Sally, that one.
Also, we have Muslim friends, and they think that there's some type of scripture also in the Bible, which I have not found, that says that, like, Ham was, like, left somewhere or, like, stayed somewhere.
I think they watched that Noah movie. That's what it was.
Not beats me. So I haven't seen it. So, gosh, that Noah movie was so bad.
Hey,
it had so much potential.
It was okay towards the end.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Why do they all have to screw up God? God has to. You know, they all jack God up. So anyway, so that's the idea. So that's how I believe we got that much water on the earth. Okay. So Noah, his sons, his wives are in the boat. 40 days we get rain. Okay. And then again, let's just watch this cool process of how they get in, okay? 13, on the very same day, Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth, the sons of Noah, Noah's wives, the 3 wives of his sons with them, enter the ark. Every beast after its kind, every cattle after their kind, every creeping thing after its kind, all the kinds. Again, kinds doesn't mean species, by the way. God is bringing kinds. We talked about this with creation. Kinds are groups of animals that can interbreed. So a wolf, a coyote, a dog, a dingo, those are all maybe the same kind. So from them, you get the species that we have today. So if you're able to interbreed, that would be considered a kind. There's some kind of fun numbers that I think people have done on this, the idea of, can you really put that many things in a boat? Is that even possible? The math works out. So if you care to know it, I can bore you with a bunch of math. That,
well, didn't he say 2 of each, though?
Male and female.
Yeah.
Correct, male and female zebra.
Oh, okay. So,
or a male and female dog that would constitute, you know, every other thing they could breed from it, you wouldn't bring all those in.
When I was little, I thought it was every single animal in the world, and I was just like, yo, dang, this thing gotta be huge.
Well, every species that we see today would have been represented on the ark at some point. Even, the idea would be, even dinosaurs that were there at that time would have been on the ark. How is that possible?
Well, dinosaurs are too big, so they were left.
Potentially. What would be the other option if they were not too big and brought on the ark? Are there small dinosaurs? Are there baby humans? Yeah, you bring a small dinosaur, right? So the math works out. If there are 18,000 kinds of animals, which is kind of the generic belief that today there are about 18,000 kinds of animals, if you bring two of those plus enough for sacrifice and so on and so forth, again, guys doing crazy math, okay? Yep. Correct. So yeah, there would have been plenty for extra sacrifice.
Why do you call it unclean animals?
We're going to see in Leviticus, God's going to determine some animals as clean and some animals as unclean, and that is a theme of the book of Leviticus as to what that even means. So, some use soap, some don't. Clean, unclean. So, it's not that. Okay. We'll get there. Roll. Anyway, so the idea is they could all fit. The potential is there. If you brought sheep-sized animals, you could get 125,000 sheep, 125,000 sheep on that boat that Noah built, okay, in 1.4 million cubic feet with the decks and so on and so forth, okay? So that's the idea. I know it's fascinating. So let's get to the good stuff, okay? Verse 16. Those that entered, male and female, all flesh, as God had commanded them, and the Lord closed it behind them. So they get on, God shuts the door, God seals the door. The flood came in verse 17 for 40 days, and the water increased and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. The water is going to prevail. It's going to continue to get higher and higher until all the mountaintops are covered. Verse 20, the water prevailed 15 cubic feet higher. Cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. All the flesh that moved, verse 21, in the earth perished. Birds, cattle, beasts, every swarming thing swarms upon the earth. All mankind, look at 22. All that was on the land, all in whose nostrils with the breath and the spirit of life, died. All died. So if you're not on the ark, you're dead. If you breathe air, you're dead. Yeah, God's plans are, I don't know. This was just, for whatever reason, this is how God chose to do it. So it's fascinating. But yeah, there was a lot easier ways to go about this. So God blotted out every living thing in verse 23. The water prevailed in verse 24 on the earth for 150 days. So they've been on there the 7 days that they were on. Now 150 days as they are sitting through this deluge of rain. But God, in verse 1 of chapter 8, remembered Noah as if he forgot him. All the beasts that were in the cattle, everything that's there, all the fountains of the deep in verse 2 and the floodgates of the sky were closed, so God shut it off. The water receded steadily from the earth in verse 3, and in the end of 150 days, the water decreased. Now, Ark ends up on Mount Ararat. We believe that to be somewhere in Turkey today, but that is where the Ark comes to its resting place. Yeah, Joseph. Yeah. What does that refer to? It's good, because we're going to see that repeated throughout.
Yeah, he's like, I remember David.
Yeah.
He put him in suffering, yep. And then he remembered David.
Yep.
Or they call out a prayer, it's like, remember your servant.
Yep.
What do they mean by, it's not like God forgot about him.
In lieu of chapter 6, and that word that I just taught you, what is God remembering? His covenant. He's remembering his promise. And it's not that he forgot his promise. It's the idea of God is saying, I'm going to stay true to that. And our best language to describe that is God is calling to mind the promise, the unconditional promise that he made to Noah. And it feels like, how do you think Noah felt for 150 days? You think he felt the opposite of remembered? You think he felt like God forgot him? Like, what the heck? Like, this is insane. He spent half a year, 5 months, in a boat, every, you know, with stinky animals that do what stinky animals do. I mean, you probably feel pretty forgotten, but God says, I remembered Noah, right? That's powerful. And we're going to see, again, that theme. God doesn't forget his promises. God does not forget to do what he said he was going to do. Okay, so it is very powerful imagery. So that's my take, okay? So we're on Mount Ararat in verse 4. The water decreased in verse 5 until the tops of the mountains were visible. And then Noah says, man, we're going to send out some birds, and we're going to see if there's dry land yet, okay? We talked a little about this yesterday. I want you to notice what type of bird in verse 7 does Noah start with when he sends them out? A raven, okay? Talk to me about a raven. What does a raven eat today? Dead things. They're scavenger birds, right? They're filthy, right?
It's a rat with wings.
It is a rat with wings, absolutely, okay? So, think about what a raven has available to it coming out of the ark, right? That is called a buffet, right? You've got dead things everywhere. So you just sent a raven out into a buffet. Verse 7, he sent a raven out. It flew here and there until the water was dried up from the earth. Does the raven come home? No. Why does the raven not come home? Because it's awesome out there. He's content away from the ark. That's home. That's wonderful. He has found life outside of the ark. Okay? So just keep this imagery in mind. So
How did the animals survive in there?
They would have brought food as well. Noah brought food for the animals and himself. At this point, again, they're still vegetarian. So everybody's eating vegetables. Whatever. Okay? So that's what Noah would have brought. So that's not going to change until 821 with a new covenant that's coming with Noah and the rest of the animals and everything else, okay? So, 8, Noah sends out a new animal. Yep.
Maybe I missed something, but until the waters are dried up on the earth, so it's just eating dead stuff. We don't know that it just couldn't find a place to land and got too tired.
Potentially. Don't screw up my sermon illustration here, man. So, don't let the truth get in the way of a good illustration. Potentially. I mean, you probably have floating carcasses and stuff like that. So there's probably places to land. They're just not land. Maybe the tops of mountains are visible and stuff like that. But it's fascinating to me that Noah would send out two different types of birds. In the second bird, what does he send out? In verse 8. Harry Potter bird? I'm not a Harry Potter guy. My family just now watched that. I still haven't seen it. Yeah, I know.
Don't mess with Harry Potter.
Aren't you?
It's a dove.
It's a dove. Okay, thanks. Cool. Thank you. It's a dove. So he sends out a dove. What's the difference between a dove and a raven?
One's white, one's black.
There you go. Okay. How about diet? What does a dove eat?
Seeds.
Okay, seeds. Is the dove going to find the same satisfaction that a raven will outside of the ark? Why? It's not eating dead flesh. That's not on the menu for that bird, right? So notice this. The dove goes out to see if the water had abated from the land, but the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot. So she returned to him in the ark, and the water was on the surface of the earth. Okay. What does Noah's name mean, by the way?
Rest.
So the dove flew out of the ark and found no rest. No Noah. No. It's not the same word, but the etymology is similar. So the dove doesn't find any peace, any rest outside of the ark. So what does the dove do? Dove comes back to the father. Okay. Noah's going to send the dove out again, and then finally a third time. And until there is vegetation and dry land enough for the dove to find a suitable habitat, it will come back to the ark every time. Okay. That's the idea. Somebody had a question. I don't know. That's a great question. I'm not sure. Probably just because females are better than males. I don't know. Yeah, there you go. I don't know. That's good. Okay. So just illustration-wise, I think this is fascinating. So somebody asked the question yesterday about election and what happens with somebody that walks with God for a long season of time, looks like a Christian, acts like a Christian. You see fruit in their life. You see a solid testimony. And all of a sudden, some life event happens and makes that person just absolutely like, and walks away from God, okay? How do you know what the end game is for that person? Was that person a Christian? Are they living in disobedience? with these two animals as a as an illustration, this would be my answer. A person who truly is converted is not going to find life outside of the ark. Now, I don't know how long you can fly around out there. I don't know how long you can spend eating a buffet of death until you finally realize, man, this is not bringing me joy. This is ultimately not fun. As Christians, we can spend time living a life in sin, in disobedience. But ultimately, if the Spirit of God is in us, there will be conviction. There will be a sense of, man, this is fruitless. This is hopeless. I need to return to the Father. Okay? The dove does that. The raven doesn't. Somebody that's unconverted, there's not a Spirit of God within them, man, they can find life all day long, if you will, in that environment without conviction, okay? So I think it's an interesting picture. Now, again, it's hard to put timetables on that. This is not why Noah wrote this. Sorry, Moses wrote this about Noah. This isn't the point of the two birds per se. It's just an interesting, interesting parallel, if you will, okay? So when you see people walking in disobedience, the question is, were they ever converted? And if they can find life outside of the Father, then okay, maybe they weren't. Or are they just in a season of disobedience and God will draw them back? And they'll spend enough time throwing up what they've eaten, realizing, man, my body cannot digest that. I am a new creation. I'm not a raven. I'm a dove. That's not going to work. They will come home and God will draw them home. Okay? So that's my take. Okay? So back to the boat. So dove goes out in verse 12, he waited yet another 7 days, sent the dove out for now the third time, and the dove did not return, meaning there's dry land. There's a place where the dove can find rest. Now Noah realizes, okay, we're going to be getting out of the boat soon. Verse 13, it came about in the 601st year, the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth. Noah removed the covering from the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. Okay, again, just over a year in the ark, 377 days for all of those that want to win some Bible trivia. There you go. Okay, God spoke to Noah in verse 15. In 16, he says, go out of the ark, you, your wives, your sons, and your sons' wives. Bring out with you every living thing of the flesh that is with you, birds, animals, everything that we brought in. Be fruitful and multiply, verse 17. So the command again. So Noah went out, he and his sons, every creeping thing in verse 19 that moves on the earth, they went out with their families from the ark. And the command again is to be fruitful and multiply, subdue the earth. So we've got eight humans and two of every kind of animal and some animals that we're about to see sacrificed here in verse 20. And that is what is remaining on the earth now after a year plus of a worldwide or potentially localized flood. Okay? So verse 20, Noah built an altar to the Lord and took every clean animal and every bird and offered clean birds and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So again, different type of offering that we've seen before. Now we have a burnt offering from Noah. 21, this is fascinating. Somebody read that and just see God's response to this burnt offering. All right. Have you guys ever smelt burnt hair or burnt flesh? It is a distinct, awful smell. How does God respond to that? What does he say? It's a soothing aroma. Why would that language be used? Why is that bigger than just the simple smell of it all? Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the act of blood sacrifice. It's the act of atonement. And that smell is unique to that picture. And that's what God's saying, man, that is amazing. Now, by the way, did the intent of man's heart change after the flood? No. Nothing's changed, okay? We've got a guy that maybe is more righteous than some of the others, but his heart is intent on evil, just like his wives, just like his sons and his sons' wives. They're still evil, just like the rest of them, okay? So God says, I will never again curse the ground on account of man. So we're going to see a shift. This is the beginning of the Noahic covenant here in 21. We're going to see it established, if you will, ratified here in chapter 9. God's going to continue that idea of what he means by that. Okay? So 9:1, let's pick up from here. Okay? God blessed Noah, said to his sons, be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth. The fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and every bird of the sky with everything that creeps on the ground, all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are given. What does that mean? That the terror of you shall be on all animals. Not just obey.
You have dominion,
dominion, but it's more so. They already had dominion. Yeah, okay. Now, set up the food chain for me. You've got Noah versus lion. Who's winning? No, not naturally. Who's winning?
Lion.
They are faster, they are bigger, they are stronger. You put us on the food chain in terms of power and speed, we lose all those battles, right? We may be able to take a porcupine, maybe, right? So what does God do to equal out that balance, if you will? He puts the fear of us in them. So animals are afraid or are going to keep their distance, if you will. So that's, and Noah still has to subdue. He's going to have those for food. We're going to see that change, but in a, we are not the top of the food chain. By eating meat,
well,
or
violence.
Yeah, I think that's part of the curse that we see is that, that change. But part of the allowance here is that they can. But yeah, I think prior to a fall, everybody would have been vegetarians, all animals. So there was no animal that ate meat up to this point, which is crazy. So that's coming with the words that are about to come from God to Noah. So yeah, so think about that. It wasn't a carnivore. There are no carnivores yet. We only have herbivores? No. Yeah, herbivores.
So, but God gave to Noah the privilege to eat meat, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. And then you see that in the book of Acts with Peter. We're going to see that solidified as well, okay? And that's... No, that's going to go from the clean, unclean that we're going to talk about in Leviticus. God's going to deal with that again in the book of Acts.
Is that part of the covenant of grace? Granting of man.
Yes, God gave a steak. So, yeah, I think so. It's fair game here. Now he's going to give some rules as to what that looks like. So, I actually didn't even mean that. What's that? It does. So let's talk about what that means, okay? So... fear of animals is put into man to preserve our lives so we don't get eaten because they, again, would win most of those battles.
What happened to that fear and to animals with us now?
Still there.
It's still
there. Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know because I'm not running up.
Yeah, well, that's called wisdom. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. So God says, man, this is different. Every moving thing is now on the menu, just as I gave green things. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life. That is its blood. Okay? So you can eat animals, but you can't eat animals with its flesh, with its blood. Surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Okay? And we're going to get into kind of a different... God's taking this somewhere. But what does that mean, that you can't eat meat with its life, with its blood? Dead? Not just dead. Raw. It needs to be cooked, okay? What's the picture here? Why is God saying no uncooked meat? Potentially. I think it's bigger than that. Why is the blood so significant to God? It's a picture of sacrifice. And that picture is God's picture, okay? So when you eat meat, Noah, you need to cook it. It needs to change. So that the picture of blood sacrifice and its flesh is unique to this sacrifice, okay?
That sacrifice is only for God? That
raw meat done that way is for God. That's how you would present sacrifices. So you would kill an animal. You don't cook it. you would then put it on an altar and it would be consumed and so forth. So that whole picture is important. And the spilling of that animal's blood, the blood is what covers. So, yeah.
How is cooking it different than offering it as a burnt offering?
Because they're not eating it raw. So I think that's the idea.
They don't eat it, they'll just burn it.
Correct. There are some offerings that they will eat after they're cooked in Leviticus. We'll see that. Okay?
So I'm not really clear on these offerings, these altars. Like, he built an altar. I'm not familiar with the process. Is that going to be covered in Leviticus?
We'll get there. But yeah, we can talk about it here. An altar simply is like a big rock pile at this point. Okay? Unhewn rocks, they're not anything special. They're a bunch of rocks put together in a pile. So it would look out of place, but it's just a pile of rocks that are there, and then you would offer, in this case, animals, clean birds. He would have killed them and laid them on a rock pile and offered those to God.
And then Noah sets them on fire, or God's spirit comes and sets them on fire?
We don't see the details here, if that even happened in this one. We'll see the formal process when we get the tabernacle put together in the priesthood moving as to how that actually occurs. We don't know, okay? Divinely setting something on fire is pretty unique. We see that with Elijah, when Elijah makes an altar and calls upon his name, and God brings down fire from heaven. That is very unique. So I don't think that happened here, but that's the picture, okay?
When they brought fire upon those guards.
Especially think of, like, halal and, like, how they drink the meat from their blood before they even buy it. Like, are we still being obedient when we buy blood that has meat in it?
Meat that has blood in it? I know what you're saying.
Wait, sorry.
Yeah, I'm tracking with you. I think so. And again, we live New Testament. We live under a dispensation of grace. It's different, okay? Here's a tricky one. So what happens when, even today, when you go overseas and in certain cultures, they drink blood? They eat raw meat? James just threw up in her mouth right there. Sorry. Do you, for the sake of the gospel, partake in that so as to not offend the culture that you're in? Or do you say no? Because I need to walk with God, and God says, don't eat meat with blood in it. You know, those are real-life missionary tensions of the world that we live in, okay? What I do know from this text is sushi is sin. I'm kidding. I don't like sushi, so it's easy for me not to eat it. I'm teasing. So, but you get the picture, okay? Blood sacrifice, that blood is important to God, so he says, that picture, that symbolism, the significance of that is mine. Cook your meat first. That's the idea, okay? So, but enjoy your meat. Have a prime rib. Have a steak. Have some chicken. Okay, it's all good, okay? Now, watch this picture, okay? Surely, verse 5, I will require your lifeblood, your blood, your life from every beast I will require it, and from every man. Every man's brother I will require it, life of man. For whoever, in verse 6, sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. As for you, be fruitful, multiply, populate the earth. What are we talking about here? What is God saying? What is he instituting? If you kill somebody, your life's going to be taken. By who? By man. So if I go out today, decide I'm going to murder somebody in this dispensation, what's the punishment for me? My lifeblood will be shed by my fellow man, fellow mankind, as a result of that. What do we call that? That's capital punishment, right? Now, did capital punishment go away in the Old Testament, or is it still around today? It's still around today, okay? I would agree with that. Why? How could you defend that biblically, that capital punishment is still something that God says, I've given that authority to government to take life when necessary? Yeah, but that's all government. How about from God? Where do you go in the Bible to say? What's that? Yeah, to a degree. Okay, turn real quick to Romans chapter 13. This is Paul speaking about, by the way, an oppressive Roman government. Okay, so just to keep that in mind, the government that Paul's talking about he did not care for. He did not like, per se. Romans were awful to Jews in a lot of ways, and awful to the people around them. I want you to listen to how God speaks through Paul in talking about how he's to handle human government. So chapter 13 of Romans is about human government, okay? Somebody pick up in 13:1. How about that? That's some theology for you. There is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. So you're telling me even the evil, awful governors, princes, kings, here, there, everywhere are established by God. Yeah, it doesn't mean they're obedient to God. It doesn't mean that they love God. It doesn't mean that they rule in a way that God would, but they're established by God. They're not accidental. As a result, Paul says we should be in what to them? Submission, subjection. We should submit ourselves to governing authority. So, you know, I don't really care to drive 50 down Shepherd at 5:30 in the morning. There's no one out. I like to drive 70, but the speed limit says 50. So I drive 60. 10 over is okay. That's the idea. There are things that I may not like about my governing authorities. If they are not asking me to sin and violate the word of God, then I need to put myself in subjection to them. That's my authority.
This is a good illustration of that with Daniel, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We see him obey, and that's a fascinating text that unfortunately we don't get into in here. But yeah, Daniel lived in Babylon under their laws and did fine, okay? Therefore, verse 2, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. So don't do stupid, and stupid won't come back on you. You oppose government, and you can expect opposition. Okay, verse 3, here's where it gets fun.
For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong.
Is that right? If you drive the speed limit, if you're not doing anything stupid, do you fear government? No. Like, I'm not worried about anybody showing on my doorstep today and arresting me. I got nothing to hide. There's no, I'm not breaking the law in any way. So they're not a source of fear for me, right? Because I'm doing right, right? All of you feel that way? Most of you. Some of you are questionable, sketchy. But most of you feel that way, right, about government. Because we're not living crazy lives, you know, where we're out doing dumb stuff that we're going to get punished for. Okay? Derek, keep rolling in end of verse 3.
To be free from fear of the one in authority, then do what is right, and you will be commended.
Okay, live right, and you have no problem with the government. Keep rolling in 4.
For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer.
What does that mean, that it, and your translation translated it well, the idea of government is a minister of God. It does not bear the sword for nothing. What's this concept that Paul's talking about, to bear the sword?
It acts out as judgment.
Absolutely. They have the authority to act out judgment. To what degree? They can give me a speeding ticket. If I decide that I don't like the room set up and I murder Kyle because of it, probably won't go there. Understandable. What does government have the authority to do to me? Take my life, right? New Testament, by Paul. Paul is saying that capital punishment is still around, and that is still a process that's given by God to human government. So it appears that this idea of bearing the sword goes all the way from the smallest of punishments all the way up to the most grievous offense of taking another person's life. You need to expect that by the hands of men and women, you may have your life taken from you as a result of that, and God has given that authority to human government today. Okay? So
by the government.
Yeah.
It's kind of unrighteous.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, as we look around today, we see a whole lot of examples of very ungodly government. You know, maybe we'll keep it overseas. We see lots of people ruling countries that are clearly ungodly, and we see the suffering of people as a result of that, that are clearly not getting their just rewards for sin. They are clearly, they are victimized individuals because of government authorities that are evil. Okay, that certainly happens. So aside from that, in a right system, when we're trying to uphold at least biblical ideals to some degree, God says that ability to take life is given to government. Okay, so in case you're wondering if capital punishment is still around, just a little side note, it seems to be still very much here, given by Paul to government. So back to Genesis 9. Cool. Just want to have something good to debate about tonight when we get to another cabin while Katie's having her snack. All right. Romans. Genesis. Let's go back there. Okay. What book are we in? Genesis is like the Old Testament Romans. It's, you know, sovereign election. It's all, you know, it's all there. It's good stuff. Okay. So, be populous, multiply the earth. Okay. Verse 8, God said to Noah and to his sons, I myself establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. So here comes the, like, the ratification of the covenant that we saw God hint to in chapter 8, verse 21. With every living thing that's with you, verse 11, I establish my covenant, my berith with you. All flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, neither shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Okay? One of the aspects of the Noahic covenant is what? What is God promising never to do again? Yeah, we're not going to see the earth destroyed by a flood again. Now, are we going to see the earth destroyed again?
Yes,
that's coming. See also the book of Revelation, okay? But not by a flood. Why would God do this, by the way? How many times have they seen rain on the earth?
Once.
And this is what it ended up in. So if you walk outside, you know, the next day and it's raining, what are you thinking? Oh, we're all going to die. You know, God says, no. That was a one-time thing. Relax. Rain's awesome. Okay. So. Sprinkler system's done. Okay. So now we're going to see the earth watered by rain. God doesn't want man to freak out. So he says, man, this is my covenant with you. I will never, ever destroy the earth by that again. Okay. So that's the idea. Verse 12. Keep rolling. Oh, I'm sorry, Sean, go ahead.
I know this is maybe a Sunday school thing, but like, so literally they would not have seen a rainbow before this moment.
Correct. Yep. And they're about to. Absolutely. So this is the first instance of that, okay? Verse 12. Sean, speaking of, read that.
And God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth.
God set his bow, his instrument of warfare, he sets in the cloud as a sign of the covenant between him and Noah and his family. What is that? It's a rainbow, right? Yeah, does it? It's what it is, okay? So this, again, this would have been the first time they saw a rainbow. Post-rain, the prism, you guys understand the concepts of rainbows and sun and all that. This is the first time they've seen it. So when it rained and the rain began to clear out and Noah looked upon the sky and saw a rainbow, that was a sign of the covenant. That was a reminder for Noah to say, God, you're good. God, you're keeping your promise,
so
right?
Every time we see a rainbow, we can think of Noah's.
That's the idea, which is so unfortunate, right? When you think rainbow today, do you think God's covenant with Noah?
Yes.
No.
Yes, I do.
Well, good. You should. Okay. It's unfortunate that that symbol has gotten hijacked to mean something very different than it originally meant. Okay. That's actually a very biblical symbol. And it's unfortunate, again, that when we think about that, that meaning has been very much twisted. Originally, when God did it, he meant it as a sign to say, man, breathe easy. Relax. I'm good. I'm not going to destroy you. No, I think it's just it's a picture of God saying, this was my instrument of destruction, and I'm setting it down. So it's a picture of God saying, we're not going to do this again. Fear not. So, yeah, I don't know that it means too much more than that, okay? So he sets his bow in the clouds. They see a rainbow for the first time, and that's the covenant, okay? So a new season of life, a new dispensation, if you will, now with men and animals so we can eat meat. God's not going to destroy the earth with a flood. Vapor canopy is gone. We now have the sprinkler system that's shut off, and we're going to see the rain come and continue to water the land by that means, which we've never seen before, okay? Verse 16, when the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every creature of flesh on the earth. So, again, it's just a beautiful picture of what God did there.
In the beginning of Genesis, when he said he separated the waters from the waters, mm-hmm. are those the waters that this is referring to?
I think so.
He literally took the ocean.
Yep.
And it was just.
Yep. The waters that were there that started in that chaos in 1-2, he separates. Some of those become sea, and some of those become the vapor canopy. And the air in between is the atmosphere that God created where they've been living. So that upper bottle thing of water just got popped, and that's what allowed that much water on the earth to cover mountaintops. Yeah, that's my best understanding of that. Yeah, it's a fascinating theory. You wonder, right? South America and Africa seem to fit real well together, right? It's just, you wonder and go, I don't know. So, we'll find out when we get to heaven. Add that to your list of questions, okay? Yeah. It's a lot of movement in a year, but yeah, still, okay? Now, 18, it's about to get weird again, okay? God established the sign of the covenant with Noah in 17, okay? We're good there. Noah got off the boat in verse 18, with Shem, Ham, and Japheth, okay? Now we're going to see the genealogy of Noah and his sons, okay? These were, in verse 19, the sons of Noah from the whole earth was populated, okay? So everybody is a descendant of Noah, okay? From Noah, Noah began farming. He planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent, okay? Noah is a farmer. He plants a vineyard. He drinks of the wine. Now, we don't know if this is the first time that Noah's had wine. We don't know if he was like, oh, wow, man, I thought it was grape juice, and all of a sudden, I can't see straight, right? And he laid down in his tent because he was hammered. Or if, man, he's just been on a boat for 377 days smelling manure, and he's like, I'm done. I need a beer, right? I don't know. But he gets really intoxicated, okay? It doesn't have the effect of grape juice, apparently. Okay. By the way, in this society, what does it mean that he uncovered himself inside his tent? Sorry, not to be graphic. He's naked inside of his tent. Okay. This culture, Middle Eastern cultures, Eastern cultures, China, these type of places, they are shame-based cultures. Okay. So to bring shame upon yourself is even more significant than it is here. Okay. There's a reason that... other countries would never be seen wearing some of the bathing attire that we would wear and things of that nature, because it's shameful to uncover your body to that degree, okay? In this culture, that's a big deal. So to be seen as naked was a huge act of shame. So this is a big deal. So Noah is drunk, uncovers himself. He's inside his tent, but visible, okay? And he gets hammered, okay? So that's the picture. Now, watch what comes from this. Verse 22, somebody pick up there.
Ham, the father of Canaan, mm-hmm. Saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside.
All right, so Ham, who is the youngest son, we believe, of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, he's probably the youngest. He is the father of Canaan, or Canaan. Okay, Canaan is actually probably the more correct pronunciation of that. Sees his father's nakedness and goes to tell his two brothers outside. Read into that for me a little bit. What is Ham doing? Yeah, you get the idea that he's kind of mocking his father, reveling in his father's sin. He's not dignifying his dad. Now watch the response of the two older brothers when they hear about this. 23.
But Shem and
Japheth, keep rolling. So what do they do? Yeah, they cover their father, right? To take his shame away. How do they do that? They put a blanket on their shoulders and literally walk backwards to their dad and lay the blanket down. They don't look at him. They don't gaze with satisfaction. Ham seems to have some type of like, he's kind of mocking his dad. He's reveling in his dad's sin. And his older brothers don't respond that way. They cover him to try to dignify him. Now, this doesn't excuse Noah's sin. We never see this dealt with in the text, by the way. But there's an odd picture here. Yeah, there.
So, what gives you the indication that he's mocking his father again?
Yeah.
The but Shem and Japheth and how they handled it. And Ham's about to get cursed because of his actions. So Noah's going to, when he wakes up and realizes what's happened, and apparently hears the story of how his son reacted, God's going to curse Ham because of his actions. You're like, wow. And it's not a small curse. It's significant. So lots of questions. Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I was reading it, and what I thought it was, the curse was, I didn't read that he was doing it to shame his father. I read it, and I got the feeling that he was cursed because he knew what he should have done, but instead he still went and told his brothers about it first, because he probably knew this isn't right.
Yeah.
And that he should be covered, but yeah. Instead of covering him, he went and said, hey guys, dad's drunk and he's passed out inside of his tent and I accidentally saw him naked.
Yeah, I push on that a little bit. I don't see that heart in Ham based on the curse that's coming. It's not like he's asking for help. Hey, grab the other side of the blanket and help me cover dad. You almost get the impression, I don't know if you guys have been in seasons like this. I spent some time in a fraternity, right? I trusted Christ in the midst of a group of people that were like 1 foot in hell. I mean, that was the fraternity I lived in, right? They were just unruly, crazy guys. Shay and I were in the same fraternity. I came to Christ because of Shay's example. And there was this really weird dichotomy of these guys that were trying to walk with God and failing consistently, and guys that were just living in their own sin and debauchery to the nth degree. They would revel in the fact to try to get Shay and I to do stuff that they knew we wouldn't do, right? They wanted us to sin so that they could feel better about their own debauchery, right? They hated the fact that we wouldn't go get drunk with them, that we wouldn't do certain things, right, that were part and parcel to their life. And not in a judgmental way, but we were trying to live our lives differently. They reveled in the fact that they wanted us to sin. Does that make sense? That's the impression that I get with Ham. He's enjoying the fact that his father has sinned.
But I think of it like,
mm-hmm.
And then his son sees it.
Correct.
Maybe his son's like, oh God, dad's naked, what do I do? And is going for help. Or like, I'm interested, and I know that I can't, I don't even know if it's a dumb question, but
yeah.
I don't understand how Noah wasn't cursed or God wasn't like,
yeah.
What's up, Noah?
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't have been naked,
yeah,
if he wasn't drunk.
Let's be clear. This does not excuse Noah's actions. Noah gets drunk. Drunk is wrong. We know that, okay? But God does not deal with Noah. The punishment needs to fit the crime. Okay, so based on what we're going to see, again, reading in context, as Shay's taught you with hermeneutics, we need to put the whole pieces together. Okay, so, yeah, Joseph.
Okay, it says in verse 18, Ham is the father of Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
In that, why didn't it describe who the father of Shem and Japheth was?
Ham doesn't get cursed. Canaan gets cursed, which is fascinating as well. He's the guy that gets called out, and we don't know why. Commentators are all over the place with this. Well, wait a second. Ham did this. Why are you cursing Ham's son, Canaan? So was Canaan involved and not mentioned? We don't know. It's a weird text, especially because of what's coming, okay?
Wait, so Ham doesn't get cursed?
His line gets cursed, okay?
Oh.
So Ham's line, because of what Ham does, Ham's got multiple sons, 4, I think. It's Canaan, specifically, one of his sons that gets cursed, okay? So, I don't think it is his youngest. Okay, let's keep reading. Okay, let's keep going and let's kind of figure this out. Okay, Shem and Japheth took the garment, covered their dad. When Noah awoke, verse 24, from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. Some of your versions may say younger. I think it's youngest. Okay, so he said, "Cursed be Canaan, not Ham. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." You are now going to be in subjection to your older brothers, Shem and Japheth, okay? Which he was already because he's the younger son in a sense, but now it's a curse because of his actions. He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. Let Canaan be his servant, and may God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan be his servant." So two sons get blessed, Shem and Japheth. Okay. By the way, Abraham is going to come from Shem, and the rest of the line is going to go through that lineage. Shem, by the way, means the name. Okay. Japheth is going to be blessed because of Shem, because of these two guys' actions and what they did. They're blessed because of Cain. Because of Ham's action, Canaan specifically gets cursed and are called to be servants. Well, he's the father, so he can, and apparently there's obviously story here that we're not getting, right, that we're not privy to some of it, but he felt that that was a right response to that. So, and again, I don't excuse Noah's sin. Noah blew it. But whatever Cain did, Canaan or Ham did, we're going to see cursed, okay? So there may be more to the story. Yeah.
And so it's like kind of like.
It's the same word in the Hebrew. Contextually, we need to not paint a 1950s American view of slave on them, but they're in subjection to their older brothers. So
it's pretty much whatever the brother. So the brother is this rule.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Okay. Correct. Yeah, I think so. I think this is not this isn't a wrong curse. I think this is, it's righteous in what he's doing because of
and
the action.
Does, like, it creates, like, this is what actually happened. So, like, I'm saying, like, is that, like, an authority that God gives him? Because, like, if my parents were to say something like that to me, it would be, like, a statement. Like, I just don't think it would, like,
I gotcha.
Be indicative.
Exactly.
Of
no, in that dispensation, yes. In the same way when the father gives his final blessing to his kids, like, man, he says, that's what you are, that's what you're going to be, period. So it's very different than, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I think he'll be an architect. Okay, thanks, Dad. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so your life is kind of spelled out that way. Yeah, Derek. Do you have a thought?
So there's this passage in the New Testament. I'm like a professional paraphraser, so forgive me. But what happens is, I guess God gives people some money, and then he goes away.
Yep.
And then I guess two out of the three people who gave money profited from
yep.
it, but the other person was afraid to lose the money,
yep.
so he didn't do nothing.
Yep.
So then when God came back, he took what the guy who didn't profit anything
yep.
gave it to the other guy.
Yep.
Is that kind of this idea here, the fact that the younger brother didn't actually make better out of the situation, but ran out of fear to his brothers? I don't like to say that he was ridiculing his father, but that he was afraid of the situation and he didn't
yeah.
act on it
yeah.
out of compassion, but rather he went and told his brothers.
Yeah.
It's kind of this,
I see it as greater than that. By the way, some have suggested that the sin of Ham may have even been sexual. Some of the language you go, oh, maybe. Okay. By the way, when we see Sodom and Gomorrah and we see that town fall, a guy by the name of Lot is going to leave that city, and he's going to get taken out of there forcefully by God, and he's going to end up spending the night in a cave. He gets hammered, just like Noah, and he's in there with his two daughters. And both of his daughters have sex with him in order to populate their lines, because they think everyone on the earth is dead. Okay, so this is Genesis 19. It's not a far cry from where we're at. And there's two countries, two groups of people that come out of that, the Edomites and the Moabites. So some have suggested maybe because this curse is so strong that maybe there was something involved with Ham that was sexual, or maybe Canaan as to why he specifically is cursed. The other thing that's even more problematic, I talked to you guys about the verse of Cain and Abel and the sign that was put on Cain is to not mess with him. As you look in chapter 10, we get a genealogy, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Each one of the kids, their genealogies are written. Guess who, by the way, are the people of Canaan and where they end up, and specifically what color their skin is. They're darker-skinned people. They live in the land of Israel, Canaan, the land of Canaan, as well as to the south and in Africa, okay? So people have taken this text to say, see, people with dark skin, they're cursed. They're not as good as the people with fair skin. And again, I think that is equally wrong. By the way, the Canaanites are not around today. What's that?
My friend's dad told me that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, what?
You should slap him. Don't even warn him. Just back him. The Canaanites are no longer around. So whatever curse occurred to them doesn't apply. But it is fascinating, okay? On a biblical scale, the people of the land of Canaan just got cursed. And where do they live? They live in the land that God is going to give, a piece of the land that God is going to give to Israel, to Abraham, and tell him to live in. Do we still see that tension 4,000 years later between the Canaanites and the Israelites? Yes. I mean, so even here in Noah's day, we see the beginnings of this animosity and this difficulty. Okay, so again, I don't know what it is. I see this as just by a just action by, we know Noah to be righteous overall. Like, I don't think he's flying out the hammer in anger or hungover and mad. I think he's giving a righteous statement of like, this is your curse as a result of that. Okay, so it's a difficult text. I do not believe in generational sin. I don't think that, you know, I'm paying for the sins of my father. God is not cursing me today because of something my biological father did. That is an unbiblical concept, but something in here called Canaan out, okay? So anyway, so let's keep moving. I want to see if we can get through a bit more, okay? So two sons get blessed in the midst of this, Shem and Japheth, okay? Shem, again, is where Abraham's going to come from, and then from there moving forward, okay? So again, we have seen now, up to this point, a lot of... tried. TV cart. All right. We've seen a lot of the planks falling out. In case we've seen God, man, sin, redemption, civilization. No, I don't want slideshow. Civilization, and now judgment is the 6 through 9 piece that we just finished. So we're ending now this second to last plank of now the nations and these people experiencing, this nation at least, experiencing judgment. Okay, so 6 through 9 is about this idea of judgment. We're going to cover now the last two planks, or the last plank, in these last two chapters, okay? Chronologically, chapter 10 occurs after chapter 11. 11, Babel, is going to explain, how do we end up with all these people groups? How do we end up with all these languages? How do we end up with all these nations, different colors of skin, different dialects, different cultures, religions, all of that stuff, okay? So, we won't go in great detail in chapter 10, but what you need to know, it is a genealogy of the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. You'll notice Japheth is first, 5 verses. Then you get Ham, who's 6 through 20. And then Shem is the last one, who gets kind of maybe a bit more of the bulk of the text. Okay, and you don't see all these lines get cursed. By the way, look in 10 verse 8, Cush became the father of Nimrod. This is a Hamite. This is someone from Canaan who became a mighty hunter on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Okay, before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. So you see even, there's hints of godliness in Ham's line, in Canaan's line, even though this Canaan got cursed.
What did Nimrod do for him to be associated with?
Poor guy. Right, he turned into a Nimrod. I don't know. Yeah, it's a rough lineage right there. So don't name your kid Nimrod. Or do. It's like a boy named Sue, and he'll be super tough. So anyway, okay? So that's chapter 10. You get those genealogies. Now, in 11, here's what I want to get to. This is the Tower of Babel. And we're going to see, again, nations, races, and religions come from this, okay? 11:1. Someone pick up there for me. Literally, there's one language on the earth, okay? Ronan, our Hebrew guide, would tell you it's Hebrew. I don't know what it was, okay? But there's one language. Everybody speaks the same language, okay? Keep rolling.
It came about as they journeyed east
Which way?
East.
Okay.
That they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there.
Where is Shinar? Shinar.
Iraq.
Yeah, east. Iraq, Babylon area today. Okay, Iraq today, Babylon is the area where they're settling. East of Eden. Okay, they said to one another. Keep going.
They said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone and they used tar for mortar.
Okay, so they're going to build something. Here's the something in verse 4.
They said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into the heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth.
Okay, what do you see there? Yeah. Whose name are they supposed to make a name of? God's, right? Subdue the earth, be fruitful, multiply, represent God. They say, let us make ourselves a city, a tower, a ziggurat, okay, is what this probably is. It's a place of worship, but it's not just a place of worship. It is a, Rick's going to come, by the way, on Thursday and walk you guys through the whole background of Abraham, which is fascinating. Maybe the best hour and a half you get all year. He's going to walk you through where Abraham came from, worship practices during this day, the education. It's awesome to help you understand who he is and what he's doing, okay? But they're going to build in Shinar this city, and they're going to make a tower who ultimately we know from the story is going to reach the heavens. That's what they want to do, okay? They want to make a name for themselves. So they're going to build a tower that's going to reach the heavens. Verse 5, the Lord came down. So there's some humor there. You're going to build a tower that's going to reach the heavens, and God has to come down to see your tower, okay? There's some Hebrew humor. It's meant to be there, okay? God has a sense of humor. It's a good thing. So, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built, and the Lord said, behold, they are one people. They all have the same language, and this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Before Noah got on the boat, Genesis 6:5, God said the intent of man was on evil continually, right? He gets off the boat. What was the same thing said? Same thing, right? Nothing's changed. So when God says that the purpose of what they accomplished to do, nothing will be impossible, what is he speaking of?
Evil.
The evil intentions of man's heart, right? This is not a positive thing. So God says in verse 7, here's what we're going to do to slow this process of evil. Keep reading. That word confused is literally babble, right? That we're going to confuse the language. What does that mean? Yeah. So if all of a sudden, you know, Joseph and I are hanging out, and I speak Hebrew and he speaks Hebrew, and the next day he wakes speaking Aramaic or Chinese, it's like, what am I going to do naturally? I'm going to find people that speak my language, and I'm going to hang out with them because I can communicate with them. And you're going to do the same, right? Those are going to turn into families and so on, and they're going to subdue the earth, and they're going to spread out and stay with the people that are like them because they can understand one another.
When he says, come, let us go down, kind of confuse your language.
Genesis 1. Yep, same.
What are the implications of this right now? Because we now live in a world where maybe English isn't the most spoken language, but it probably is.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Yeah, you see pictures of maybe even Babel today because we can understand each other in a different level, especially English. I don't know that I would make too many connections. I think what we're looking at here is the idea of where did languages come from? Well, they came from Babel. Where did different groups of people come from? They come from Babel. Where did races come from? They come from Babel. By the way, what is Babel? Is Babel a punishment? No. Babel is an act of grace by God to slow the process of evil. So the fact that we've got white people and black people and Aramaic and Hebrew and Chinese, is that sin? Is that a punishment? No. It's an act of grace by God. Okay? So I see all those things that stem from them. Now, what naturally occurs when you get a group of people together that now have different traditions and beliefs and generations on, what begins to develop as well?
Wars.
What's that?
Wars,
different things, as well as religion. Your interpretation of man, how did we get here? Those things begin to develop over time as well. So you've got different nations, you've got different races, and you've got different religions, okay? Not all of them are going to be followers of Yahweh. We're going to see other people groups that rise up. We're going to see the Baals, the people that worship different gods, and Molech and Chemosh, all these other different people groups that worship a different god, have different systems of belief. So Babel is the spark of that, the beginning of worship of different things as well as nations and races as well, okay? But I want you guys to see that's an act of grace, okay? If we see this as wrong, then all of a sudden different skin tones, different languages that are other than what originally was created are, by the way, evil and bad, which would be white as well, just to be clear, okay? If you look at the group of people that were created during this time, what color, more than likely, would their skin tone have been? Not white, for sure not white. Probably would have looked a little bit more like Aaron, to be honest with you. Darker skin, Aramaic people, large noses, dark eyes. That would have been their complexion. Light, you're the closest in the room, okay? But that's the idea. So this white picture of Jesus that you have in your head, that is not Jesus. Jesus was not Swedish, okay? He would have been dark skin, Jewish looking, Aramaic background, dark hair, not real, like, attractive, if you will. Like, he wasn't a guy that stood out physically because of his features. We've got a very wrong picture of Jesus in our head, most of us.
Where is, I was going to say, where is Babel located again? And you said that's...
Modern-day Iraq. Iraq. And in the land of Babylon, in the studies that we'll see in the scripture.
Okay?
So that's the people group that emerged, that started. Everything that came from that... came from Babel, okay? All of our races probably included, unless some of you were Middle Eastern by descent, okay?
There's still remnants of it. My cousin has remnants of it when he was there.
Really? Cool. Yeah, interesting. I'd love to see some of that stuff. Okay? Okay, so real quick, that's Babel, okay? God confuses their language. This is an act of grace. Chapter 10, verse 10 and following, look what we get. The descendants of Shem. Now we get the list of the genealogy. One of the sons of Noah, specifically Shem. That means the name. Okay, we won't read them all, but look at verse 24. Okay, one in the line of Shem, way down. Nahor lived 29 years, became the father of Terah. Nahor lived 119 years after he became the father of Terah. He had other sons and daughters, 26. Terah lived 70 years and became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Abram is Abraham to be. His name's going to get changed by God later in the book of Genesis. So that is the connection that now Abram has with Shem. You will pick up with Rick in 11:27 and following, and you're going to see how we get Abraham. Where does he come from? Okay, Rick's going to paint the backdrop, the scenery, if you will, of the culture and the day and age that we're now finding ourselves in, and how he calls Abraham to be. It is a really, really cool story. Okay, so Rick's going to be here Thursday, and I'll be back a week from today on Friday, and we'll pick up again here. But Rick's going to set the background for you. Okay, so have a great day. Take a nap if you can. We're going to be up late partying till like at least 9, maybe 9:30, if it's crazy. Okay, we'll see you guys at 6 tonight. Enjoy your days.